say just a couple of short remarks by way of introduction. By no means the most important part, but perhaps the funnest part, is the beginning, right? I bring the bear out. So this time last year, when the previous president before me, Emma McCabe, introduced me, she brought this bear out of her bag and pointed out that 30 years earlier, I had given it to her when she was a little bit down for good luck, and it had brought her good luck, and she was passing it on to me. She and I talked last week, and we decided it's coming your way. That's right, it's coming your way. And she and I decided that it has become the Aristotelian Society presidential bear. And so I'm passing it on to Claudia for her to have during her presidency, and presumably she will pass it on to this her presidency, and it will be awesome. Okay, that's the bear bit. Now, I want to say a remark or two about education, about positions that Fabian has held, about editorial work she's done, and of course about her research, and then I'll pass it over. So she did, if I understand this right, almost all of her education set up from bachelor level all the way up to doctoral level, where she also taught for a while. Then she moved to Basel, where you did the habilitation, which is like a big deal, believe me, and was assistant professor in Basel. Is that right?
Yep.
And then after a few years, we got lucky in Britain, and she moved to Warwick 20 years ago. And I have spies in Warwick. And the spies in Warwick have been telling me many, many, many good things about the work that you've done in Warwick, founding PPE, really playing a central role in getting that fantastic PPE program that you guys have up and flourishing, being a very effective department head during the really tough times during COVID, and now playing a very, very important leadership role at the university level for research strategy. All of which is characteristically impressive, and echoed by my likes directly by her research. So let me talk about her research. Oh, sorry, she's also past editor of Economics and Philosophy. But you didn't do your PhD in Philosophy of Economics, did you? Oh, you did. So the possibility of justice is actually Philosophy of Economics? I see. Okay. So she's past editor of the journal Economics and Philosophy, and one of the current editors of the Philosophy and, the Journal of Moral Philosophy. She writes on an incredible range of topics throughout her career. Everything from feminist economics to moral psychology, by my lights. I mean, your latest paper in philosophical psychology is moral psychology in ways that pushes very strongly into metaethics through the idea of fittingness and affordance. Gibsonian psychology is fantastic. So that's a really nice paper.
Thank you.
And, she's edited a couple of books on, the first collection I think was called Rationality and Commitment. Then there was a collection that was on, what was it called?
It was on public health ethics.
Oh, that's right, public health ethics and equity, interestingly, and equity. She has two single-authored volumes. The first one came out in 2008, and it's called Democratic Legitimacy. And then just last year, a really impressive book called The Grounds of Political Legitimacy came out. And the plural there, grounds, is important because the conception of political legitimacy defended in the book is really kind of rank ordering a couple of different kinds of grounds for when a political decision in polity counts as legitimate. First and foremost, this interesting idea of evidence-based kind of rational authority, but it has to be accessible evidence to human beings of a sort that often isn't available. And so a kind of secondary legitimacy has to do with adjudicating disagreement in appropriate ways between valid but disagreeing political conceptions. Is that fair?
Well, absolutely.
And so there are ordered grounds for political legitimacy. The book is really very interesting, highly recommended. And I want to point out, it's the last thing I want to say before I hand it over. I think the thing that impressed me the most when I was really going back and trying to look at what you put in Grazer Philosophische Studien, what you put in feminist economics, what you put in philosophical psychology, and over and over and over, you see a piece of work that's deeply edified from the theoretical end of our business and also the applied end, and it's completely clear that the work is sculpted in advance on purpose so that it will edify in both of those directions. So that the work can be something that a pure theorist in philosophy can read and learn from, but also someone that has real decisions to make in applied context, can read and learn from. And I think that's extraordinary and wonderful. So highly recommended. I turn it over to you, Madam President, for relational morals.
Thank you so much, Scott. I'm really touched, and I also fear that now I can only disappoint. But I want to start out by giving thanks of my own, and to thank the Aristotelian Society and everyone involved for the trust placed in me. I take it to be a tremendous honor to be in this role. I think the Aristotelian Society is a wonderful thing, a truly wonderful thing, and I'm absolutely delighted to be supporting it over the next year. Okay, now to the talk. Let me start with something uncontroversial, at least to the extent that anything in philosophy is uncontroversial. Our relationships matter, and they matter morally. They are abusive, toxic relationship dynamics, as well as positive ones that are enabling and enriching for the individuals involved. Now to the more controversial part, potentially. Are our relationships also a distinct source of moral demands? And if so, how? So these are the questions that are at the heart of my talk today. The main contemporary moral theories today have a non-relational structure. That is to say, they take moral demands to be grounded in the moral properties of individuals, their rights, for example, or their well-being, understood non-relationally, and not in relations between individuals. Of course, they can allow that moral demands bear on our relationships. So we might be under a demand to respect the rights of the people we are in a relationship with, or to promote their well-being. But moral demands are not grounded in the relationship. And that's where relational moral theories differ. They take at least some moral demands to be grounded in relationships. So to act rightly on those sorts of views is to act in accordance with what our moral relations to other individuals demand from us. And then within relational moral theories, there's a further distinction to be drawn, or at least that's what I will argue today, that's what I will try to convince you of. Many contemporary relational theories have what I would call an individual's first structure. And by that, I mean that they explain the moral relations that ground relational moral demands in terms of relational moral properties of individuals. And I'll have more to say about what I mean by that. A radically relational account of relational moral demands, by contrast, has a relations first, not an individual's first structure. This alternative holds that the moral relations that ground relational moral demands are normatively fundamental. They can't be explained in terms of relational moral properties of individuals. While this alternative is often overlooked and perhaps deemed as a non-starter by some people, including perhaps some of you, I will show or try to show that otherwise quite different strands of thought in relational ethics have this radically relational structure, this relations first structure. And so my aim in this paper today, in the talk, is to describe radical relationalism as a coherent alternative to individuals first relationalism, and then to lend support to the view that at least some, certainly not all, but at least some moral demands are radically relational. So, to start, I want to first go over this distinction between relational and non-relational moral demands, or relational and non-relational accounts of moral demands. So moral demands, as I understand them, have at least four dimensions. There might be more, but here are the relevant ones for my talk. They have a content, a direction, a form, and a ground. So the content is what they tell us right action is, what the moral demand is about. So there might be a demand to be generous, for example, or a demand to respect someone's bodily integrity. That's the content. The direction is whom they concern. All moral demands will have a subject and an object. The subjects are typically human beings, but potentially could also be animals. The objects, again, can be human beings, animals, potentially also plants, AI systems, inanimate objects, what have you. So that's the direction. It's the subjects and the objects, what they identify as subjects and objects. The form of moral demands is the property or relation that defines right action. It is now common in ethics, meta-ethics, to distinguish between four categories of normative properties or relations. Deontic, like obligations and permissions, evaluative, like values and virtues, reasons, and fittingness. So accordingly, when I speak of moral demands, and for the most part in this talk, I will not commit to any particular form. I will come back to this later briefly, but the moral demands might be demands of obligations, duties, demands of virtues, demands of reasons, or demands of fittingness. Finally, the ground of moral demands is that which explains in virtue of what there is a demand, why there is a moral demand, and why this is a moral demand and not a demand of law or etiquette, for example. So the distinction between relational and non-relational moral demands that I have in mind is a matter of their ground, not of any of the other dimensions as such. Non-relational moral demands are grounded in non-relational moral properties of individuals. So to act rightly on this sort of account is to act in a way that honors or promotes the non-relational moral properties of individuals. And as I mentioned, relevant properties might include individuals' rights, their dignity, their well-being or their perfection, or some act of their will, such as their consent. Relational moral demands, by contrast, are grounded in relations between individuals. So to clarify, that a moral demands concerns others does not make them relational. Relational as well as non-relational moral demands may concern others. To see this point, consider a demand to be honest towards others. The demand to be honest to others is only a relational moral demand if it is somehow grounded in the relationship between the subject and object of this demand. It is not relational if it is grounded in the moral virtue of honesty, for example, and if this virtue is understood non-relationally, or if it's grounded in the positive effects that being honest has on others, or if being honest is seen as required by honoring the dignity of others, etc. So much contemporary moral philosophy has this non-relational structure. So standard accounts of consequentialism, deontological ethics, virtue ethics are all versions of non-relational moral theories. But relational theories are becoming more popular, and they are reviving a long tradition in ethics, going back to classic Chinese philosophy, contributions in African philosophy, and in the Judeo-Christian tradition as well. In contemporary ethics, care ethicists were probably the first to reintroduce relational moral ideas. So Carol Gilligan, in her influential book, In a Different Voice, from 1982, I think it was, described the contrast between a non-relational ethics of justice, as she called it, and the relational ethics of care in the following way. The former, she thought, focuses on principles of right action that are grounded in non-relational moral properties. Principles, for example, that take the form of respect others' rights or minimize their suffering. The latter, the ethics of care, Gilligan wrote, sees moral problems as arising from, quote, a fracture of human relationship that must be mended with its own thread, end of quote. So that there are moral problems that must be mended with the relationship's own thread is, I take it, a way of saying that there are moral demands that are grounded in the relation between individuals, not in relationship-independent properties. And this idea is what I think unites all relational moral theories. So the second distinction that I want to draw is within relational theories of moral demands. So very roughly, and we'll go on to elaborate, but just to give you an idea where we're heading, the idea is this. According to a first possibility in relational ethics, that I call individual's first relationalism, the moral relations that ground relational moral demands are explained on the basis of relational properties of the individuals. So while this is a relational account, moral demands are grounded in relations between individuals, that makes it relational, but the moral relations that ground these demands are explained in terms of relational moral properties of individuals, so these relational moral properties are normatively prior to moral relations. So a relation is moral on this individual's first type of view in virtue of how it honors or promotes in relational individual properties. According to the alternative, a radically relational account, the order of normative priority is reversed. Radically relational moral demands are irreducibly grounded in moral relations. So the radically relational alternative has a relations first structure. So in the rest of this paper, I will develop this distinction between individuals first and radical relationalism. But before I go on, I want to add a clarification. And the clarification concerns the contrast between any type of relationalism and what we may call collectivism. According to collectivism, moral demands are grounded in moral properties of a collective, a we, or a plural subject, to use Margaret Gilbert's term. There might be demands of friendship, for example, grounded in the value of friendship understood as a property of a collective. Relational accounts do not ground moral demands in a collective or in properties of a collective. Instead, they ground them in a relation between individuals, a you and I, not a we. So that was the clarification. Now let's turn to individuals first, relationalism. It's warming up in here. So as mentioned, individuals first relationalism is the view that moral demands originate in moral relations, but moral relations are those that honor or promote relational moral properties of individuals. So now I need to say a bit more about what I mean by that. So speaking in general, a relational property is a property something has that depends on the relation often to something else. So the pen on my desk has the relational property of being on my desk. I'm interested here in relations between individuals. So when in what follows I speak of relational properties of individuals, I mean properties that individuals have in virtue of their relations to other individuals. So a non-moral example of a relational property of an individual is the property of being taller than. Right? Someone might be taller than someone else. Anna might be taller than Bill. And Bill might have the capacity to be taller than someone else too. So these are sort of non-moral types of relational properties of individuals. A relational moral property of an individual is a moral property of theirs that presupposes some relation to other individuals. An example of such a relational property is the property of having a claim against others for example, that they keep their promise. The thought is that this property presupposes a relation, having a claim on someone, and they are under a demand to meet this claim. So that's that's what I mean by relational properties of individuals, and specifically relational moral properties of individuals. So the key feature of individuals' first relationalism is that such relational moral properties are normatively prior to moral relations. Moral relations are explained in terms of those relational moral properties. So the claim is, of course, not that relational properties are metaphysically prior to a relation. The claim is a normative one. Relational moral properties are normatively prior to moral relations. So a moral relation is a relation that honors or promotes those relational moral properties. So let me explain this further by going through some examples of recent contributions to relational ethics that have this individual's first structure. So quite a few contributions take the key relational moral property to be some kind of capacity of having or making claims on others. So my first example using this kind of relational moral property is Stephen Darwell's view, as explained in his 2006 book, The Second Person Standpoint. So according to Darwell, deontic moral demands are grounded in second personal relations. It was, at the time, a really important contribution to moral philosophy. Relevant relations, Darwell argues, are claims of one person on another to do something. So for example, someone might claim that you remove your foot from on top of this. And moral demands are then explained on the basis of individuals' competence to recognize the validity of claims of this kind and their ability to hold themselves accountable to claims of this nature. So on Darwell's view, the emerging picture is that moral relations are relations of mutual accountability, and moral demands originate in such relations of mutual accountability. This is a clear version, I think, of individuals' first relationalism because it starts with the relational properties of individuals, their capacity to make valid claims on others and to hold themselves accountable to valid claims that others have on them. And Darwell is in fact quite explicit, I think, about this individual's first structure of his account. Commenting on relational ethics and on Gilligan's version of care ethics in particular, Darwell writes, quote, "A respect for the equal dignity of persons in the form of mutual accountability and shared second personal authority to make claims and demands of one another at all is presupposed as part of the background for voluntary adult personal relationships, so that although problems within such relations must normally be mended with the relationship's own thread," quoting Gilligan here, "this must nonetheless be within a commonly presupposed second personal framework." So in other words, Darwell rejects the idea that moral relations could be normatively prior to individual moral properties. So he rejects the idea that I will explain in a moment is at the heart of the radical relationalism. Let's look at another example of individuals' first relationalism, R.J. Wallace's relational account of moral obligations. He has a different starting point in his book, The Moral Nexus. His starting point is the Hoffeldian analysis of rights. According to this analysis, rights and duties are constitutively connected. A's right to a good is constitutively connected to B's duty to provide that good. So in The Moral Nexus, Wallace first lays bare the relational structure of this analysis, all duties are directed duties in a specific sense. They are duties to someone, the rights holder. He then broadens this analysis to include moral demands beyond those generated by rights. So he's interested in moral obligations in general and argues that all moral obligations can be accounted for in this way as directed duties originating from a relationship between a duty bearer and a claim holder. So on this view, A's duty to keep their promise to B is constitutively connected to B's claim that A keeps their promise, and there's the relation. Similarly, A's duty to respect B's bodily integrity is constitutively connected to B's claims against A. So we have a meshing of claims and duties, and that explains moral. The appropriate meshing explains moral relations, and these moral relations then give rise to moral demands. So again, this is a relational account of moral demands because it sees moral demands as grounded in moral relations, but it explains moral relations on the basis of the appropriate meshing of those claims. My third example of individuals' first relationalism is the recent contribution by Ariel Zilberman, which he calls relational primitivism. So the proposal is partly born out of an attempt to improve on Darwell's and Wallace's accounts. Zilberman objects to Wallace that while his account of moral obligations involves relational moral properties, it also involves non-relational moral properties. Specifically, Zilberman argues, Wallace ultimately explains the claims that individuals have against one another in terms of their interests, and their interest is a non-relational moral property. His objection to Darwell is, similarly, that his second personal account of moral demands involves non-relational moral properties. In this case, Zilberman argues that because the validity of claims that individuals have against one another depends on them recognizing their validity, endorsing the validity of these claims, there's a non-relational property that is part of the picture, and that's endorsement, an act of the individual's will. So, in contrast to these first two examples, what Zilberman tries to do is to offer what he describes a fundamentally relational account of moral obligation, one that does not rely anywhere in the picture on non-relational moral properties. So relational primitivism holds that moral obligations are fully grounded in moral personhood, where moral personhood is understood as a relational property. So personhood is relational, on Zilberman's view, in the sense that it captures the capacity of persons to have claims against one another. And with regard to those claims, Zilberman distinguishes between an original and a contingent interpretation of the moral status of persons. Original moral status gives rise to moral claims that persons non-contingently have against one another. So these are original claims. And Zilberman's relational primitivism holds that moral demands are obligations in virtue of representing such original claims that other persons have against you. Of course, relational primitivism would not be a relational view if personhood was understood as a non-relational moral property in the way that it often is, for example, in standard contributions to Kantian ethics. But because Zilberman interprets the moral status of persons relationally as involving this capacity to have claims against one another, it is a relational account. However, it is still a version of individuals' first relationalism because it starts from a relational moral property of individuals, namely the property of being a person. So in the accounts so far, the three discussed, moral relations are ones in which there is an appropriate reciprocal meshing of the relational moral properties of the individuals involved. But it's important to be clear that individuals' first relationalism isn't committed to this kind of reciprocal structure. And to show this, let's briefly consider my final example, which is Tadeusz Metz's version of relational ethics, recently put forward in a book from 21. I forgot the title, but something in the ballpark of an African ethics contribution. So it draws on African ethics. It's a rich treatment of relational ethics. And what he argues is that the fundamental relational moral capacity of individuals is their capacity to form friendly relations. So he summarizes his proposed criterion for right action as rightness, as friendliness. So as he sees the relationship between moral demands and relations between individuals, is that he argues that moral demands originate from individuals', quote, capacity to relate in a communal or friendly way, either as subjects or as objects. So moral relations are those that honor this capacity, the capacity to form friendly relations, but because individuals who can't act on this capacity, say because they're disabled or because of their age, they are still included, so reciprocity is not required. Asymmetric moral relations are possible. So while his account does not presuppose reciprocity, it's still a version of individuals' first relationalism, I think. And that's because Metz understands moral demands as grounded in relations that honor this relational moral property of individuals. Metz defends his account in the book as superior to both the collectivist account of moral demands and to what I call radical relationalism. According to the former, according to a collectivist account, moral demands derive from some goods of communal life. And Metz rightly objects, I think, that collectivism can't sufficiently safeguard individual concerns. He objects to what I call radical relationalism, that it is unduly particularist. He thinks that a radically relational view would forego the aim of theory building. So what I want to do in the rest of this paper is to convince you that's too quick. There's a rich tradition in relational ethics that has a radically relational structure, and in fact, that we might say we miss something if in our moral theorizing we ignore radically relational moral demands. So let's turn to that. So, just to repeat, the key feature of radically relational moral demands is that such demands are irreducibly grounded in moral relations. Radical relationalism rejects the normative priority of moral properties of individuals, whether they are relational or non-relational properties. It has, as I mentioned earlier, a relations-first structure. It holds that moral relations are normatively fundamental for at least some, but again, to repeat, by no means all moral demands. Radical relationalism might seem like a very unorthodox view. But I contend there are some prominent examples in contemporary moral philosophy, ranging from Judeo-Christian ethics, for example, Martin Buber, Kay Lockstrup, Simon Weil, to Iris Murdoch's ethics of attention, and to care ethics that I already mentioned with examples including Carol Gilligan's work, Virginia Held, and Elizabeth Conradi. Outside of moral philosophy, it seems to me there's also interest in radical relationalism. There's new work in moral psychology, which I have yet to digest. But Jared Zeigan defends what looks to me like a radical relational view from an anthropological perspective. So based on extensive ethnographic studies, he concludes that the most fundamental ethical question that seems to occupy people is, quote, how is it between us? Where the us isn't the sort of the Gilbert plural subject or we, it is a relation. He explains the us, quote, is a non-categorizable plurality of singular beings that are neither individuals nor merely part of a collective, but unique instances of being relational. So I think radical relationalism has significant explanatory power. It identifies a common thread in otherwise very different contributions to relational ethics. So to get a handle on this often overlooked alternative to individuals' first relationalism, consider the account of relational moral demands that K.A. Lockstrup presents in his book, The Ethical Demand. And here I want to briefly pause, because the person who first introduced me to K.A. Lockstrup's work, and perhaps the same is true for many of you, was Bob Stern. I may have raised an eyebrow at the time, but when it came to choosing a topic for this talk, I thought, because at that point I already knew that Bob was seriously ill, that it would be fitting to pick a topic that engages with his work. Of course, now the situation is even worse in terms that Bob is no longer with us, but I think it makes it even more fitting to engage with his work. So, Lockstrup via Bob Stern. Lockstrup's starting point is the fact of human interdependence. Because we cannot survive or lead fulfilling lives in complete isolation, Lockstrup argues, we are inevitably bound up in relations of trust. This interdependence is, in the first instance, a natural fact, and that's quite important given Lockstrup's theological background. But it is also the source of a distinct ethical demand, and that is because this trust leaves us vulnerable to one another. And so Lockstrup argues that this vulnerability creates a demand to take care of each other in all our interactions with one another. Anne-Marie Sondgaard Christensen, I think, has a very helpful account of Lockstrup's view. So she writes, in Lockstrup's view, the moral demand arises, quote, not from how one entity relates to another, but rather from the nature of the relationship itself, the trust between human beings, end quote. And in another paper further articulating what I think is the radical relational idea, quote, in Lockstrup's thinking, the fact of the relationship, the trust and the demand come first, not the parts. This means first that the fact of the relationship is the only element necessary in order to account for the ethical demand, and second, that it is only from this relationship and the demand that we are able to distinguish the parts, the subject, and the object. Lockstrup's account of moral demands is a clear example of radical relationalism. That's because it takes moral demands to be grounded in a moral relation, the fact of the relationship, without assuming that this moral relation can be explained on the basis of relationship-independent moral properties of individuals. We find a similar emphasis on the fact of the relationship in some versions of contemporary care ethics, often in the guise of the claim that moral demands arise from actual relationships to particular others. Consider my second example, which is a passage from Virginia Held's influential 1990 piece. She writes, quote, "When we focus on women's experience of moral problems, we find that they are especially concerned with actual relationships between embodied persons and with what these relationships seem to require," end quote. In Held's version of care ethics, as well as in other versions, care is a kind of attention to others with whom we stand in some relationship. And moral relations are those that practice this care, and they give rise to a distinct type of moral demands. So these two examples illustrate what I take to be the main feature of radical relationalism. It's that the moral relation takes normative priority over properties of individuals. Radically relational accounts of moral demands differ in the details, and it is not my intention today to endorse any one version. I'm just interested in this being a coherent family of views. But radical relationalism might give rise to a puzzle. How can we make sense of the idea that there are moral relations independently of moral properties of the individuals involved? There must be some distinction between the kinds of relationship that do give rise to moral demands and those that do not. An abusive relationship, for example, typically does not generate a demand to support the abuser. So the puzzle is, how can moral relations be normatively fundamental? In light of this puzzle, someone might worry that I overstate the distinction, that all relational moral demands must ultimately be accounted for on the basis of some relational or non-relational moral properties of individuals. For example, someone might argue that the sort of demands that care ethics identifies are ultimately grounded in either the relational needs of individuals, needs in or interest in intimate relationships, or even in non-relational moral properties of individuals, their bodily needs, for example. So no doubt, this is the correct interpretation for some contributions to care ethics, and it's also the correct account for some moral demands. Right? But what I want to argue is that there's also a distinct type of moral demands, which is radically relationalism. And that type of demand, I think, is at least implicitly present in some other contributions to care ethics, and it is an important type of moral demand. So Hubert Dreyfus and Stuart Dreyfus, in their paper commenting on care ethics, insist that care ethics has shone light on moral demands that do not reduce to demands to honor or promote individual moral properties, such as their needs or interest in intimate relationships or the other types of needs. So as they write, it's another quote, "It is important to be clear, as Gilligan is not, that the care perspective does not entail any particular way of acting. For example, that one should promote intimate human relationships. Caring in its purest form is not ordinary loving. It is doing spontaneously whatever the situation demands." We can further illustrate the point that there are radically relational moral demands in the context of Lockstrup's account. Lockstrup, as we saw, highlights some general features of moral relationships, that they foster trust and manage our vulnerability. So we might think that this account grounds moral demands in moral properties of individuals, such as their relational or non-relational needs. But that will be a misinterpretation. In Lockstrup's view, as explained earlier, moral demands originate from our connectedness as such, not from individual needs. On Lockstrup's view, we can only be individuals in relation, and that fact explains the relation's first structure of moral demands. So to recap, on the radically relational view that I'm trying to sell to you, moral relations can be normatively fundamental, and something of moral significance is lost if we ignore radically relational moral demands. How do we defend the view that there are radically relational moral demands? I'd say there are two main arguments. I call the first a sufficiency argument, the other is a necessity argument. So on the sufficiency argument, the claim is, or the argument goes, the way the argument goes, there are moral demands that arise from actual relationship to particular others, and ignoring such demands ignores an important category of moral demands. We can see this emphasis on actual relationships in many contributions to care ethics, as highlighted above with the Virginia Held quote. We see it also in Lockstrup's account as well as in others. So the contingency of radically relational moral demands on actual relationship marks an important contrast with individuals' first relationalism. As we saw earlier when I discussed Ariel Zilberman's relational primitivism, he emphasizes that moral demands represent original claims that individuals or persons have on one another, not contingent claims. So the view is that only non-contingent claims can be moral demands. The radically relational alternative is instead that we can't account for all moral demands in this non-contingent fashion, and that some moral demands are contingent on our actual relationship to particular others. The second related argument in support of radical relationalism is that some moral relations are distorted if we try to reduce them to moral properties of the individuals involved. Moral relations of the right kind that give rise to radically relational moral demands presuppose a non-reducible being in relation, or as we might also describe it using a term from Alfred North Whitehead, they presuppose a witness, or to put it in Martin Buber's terms, they presuppose a being with. We can illustrate the distortion worry with Martin Buber's understanding of the I-Tao relation. As is well known, Martin Buber treats the I-Tao relation as the fundamental ethical relation. He contrasts the I-Tao relation with the I-It relation, which does not just describe our relations to things, but can include our relations to other people. The I-Tao relation is a moral relation between individuals who do not consider each other as objects or as having specific properties. So as he puts it, when I confront a human being as my you or my Tao, then he's no thing among things, nor does he consist of things. So while the I-Tao relation, Buber argues, sets the moral standard, he also warns us that this relation is difficult to establish and inherently unstable. The I-Tao relation easily collapses into an I-It relation in which the relation between individuals is defined in terms of properties that they have or that we attribute to them, their needs, their wants, their interests, whatever. But such an I-It relation is a distortion of the fundamental moral relation that is the I-Tao relation. So that's the Buber case. We find a similar line of thought in Lockstrup's book, The Ethical Demand. So he also recognizes the problem of distorted moral relations. On his understanding, radically relational moral demands are silent and even unfulfillable. They are silent or unspoken because if they were the subject of claims made by an individual, that would anchor them in relationship in the dependent properties of the individuals, and then we've lost the radical relational element. We would be talking about what they need, what they want. These are properties of the individuals, and that's a different view. Radically relational moral demands are not a result of a meshing of claims we make on one another on this radical relational view. In fact, Lockstrup argues, the claims we make on others tend to be fueled by expectations that rarely do justice to the particulars of the relationship. Those expectations may be the result of self-interest or of other misplaced projections on the other. And they are often the cause of tension and conflict in relationships. A coincidence between those expectations, between the claims we actually make on others and moral demands, is therefore rare, on Lockstrup's view. Moreover, radically relational moral demands are not just unspoken or silent, they're also unfulfillable in the following sense. While they are demands placed on us, these demands are necessarily de re. They cannot be represented de dicto as demands to be fulfilled, as this would again negate their ground. They would become claims of another individual. So in Lockstrup's view, as much as in Buber's, the sort of moral relation that gives rise to radically relational moral demands cannot be reduced to individual moral properties without being distorted. So to recap, radically relational moral demands are moral demands that are irreducibly grounded in moral relations. They are contingent on actual relationships to particular others. They involve a witness or a being with. And the moral nature of those relationships cannot be explained on the basis of moral properties of the individuals involved without distortion. Now, to further add to this account of radically relational moral demands and perhaps add some plausibility to the claim that they are radically relational demands, let me discuss two objections. One targets the sufficiency claim and the necessity claim. Just to give you a preview, the first will take me longer than the second, so don't worry if you feel like this is going on too long. So a first objection is that either relational moral demands are non-contingent or the relational concerns in questions are not demands. So embracing the second horn, we might say that while the views that I've described in the previous section capture something important about our moral lives, or at least potentially important, I draw the line in the wrong place. The distinction we should draw is not between two types of relational moral demands, it's between relational moral demands on the one hand and relational moral concerns on the other, concerns that are not demands. We can develop this objection drawing on Stephen Darwell's recent book, The Heart and Its Attitudes. So we might worry that what I call radically relational moral demands concern attitude of the heart, relational attitudes such as love, trust, gratitude, or forgiveness. Darwell draws on Strawson here. Darwell argues that while attitudes of the heart play an important moral role in our relationships, they do not give rise to moral demands. They differ in this regard from attitudes of the will, such as respect or blame. While the right reciprocal meshing of attitudes of the will generates moral demands, attitudes of the heart can only be hoped for, Darwell argues. They can't ground moral demands. As he puts it, quote, both love, an attitude of the heart, and respect, an attitude of the will, bid for reciprocation, but whereas respect expects respect in return, love can only hope for its requital. So this proposal is interesting in lots of ways, and if you haven't yet read Darwell's new book, I recommend you do. But I don't think this sort of objection works, and I don't think the account that Darwell offers captures all aspects of relational moral concerns. I think it draws our attention to a distinction within individuals' first relationalism. It doesn't cover what I mean by relational moral demands. First, not all relational moral demands can be reduced to the reciprocal structure that we find in Darwell's version of individuals' first relationalism. Some relational moral concerns are non-reciprocal. Even some attitudes of the heart, such as unconditional love, for example, surpass reciprocity. So Darwell's version of individuals' first relationalism, even expanded in the way to include attitudes of the heart, not just attitudes of the will, still does not capture all relational moral concerns. And second, while I grant that what I call radically relational moral demands might involve attitudes of the heart, attitudes of the heart may figure in moral demands. The sort of demands for care that care ethics draws our attention to is full of examples. In addition, some moral demands, even as understood by Darwell, seem to be demands to act in the right spirit, where acting in the right spirit involves attitudes of the heart. So, for example, a moral demand to apologize typically includes a demand to acknowledge the other's hurt feelings, and hurt feelings is another attitude of the heart. So in some respect, Darwell echoes Lockstrup's claim that what I call radically relational moral demands are silent and unfulfillable. They can't be met as demands that someone else makes on us. I grant that much, but as we saw earlier, this need not diminish their status as demands. The way I see it, it's just a feature of radically relational moral demands that they are de re. They can't be articulated de dicto as demands. That said, this feature of radically relational moral demands raises a question about the form of moral demands. So going back to the four dimensions I distinguished earlier, so in what sense, if any, are radically relational moral demands demands? I lack the space to fully develop my answer here, I have to say, hoping for the future. The short answer is that radically relational moral demands are not moral obligations. They are demands of fittingness. They are not obligations because obligations are binding. And the inherent contingency of radically relational moral demands is in tension with the bindingness of moral obligations. I'm sympathetic to an individual's first relational account of moral obligations, and that's because that's also why I didn't criticize those contributions earlier. My point is not they're wrong, my point is just it's not the full picture of relational moral demands. So while I accept that radically relational moral demands are not obligations, I want to claim that they still entail an ought. Consider the sort of demands that intimate relationships place on us. Some of those demands are, of course, binding. For example, and we have an obligation to respect the bodily integrity of others. But intimate relationships also place many other demands on us that are of a different kind. Such demands arise in the moment and vary with the context. So a demand to push back and avoid being dominated by the other in some context may morph into a demand to hold back to avoid fueling an old argument all over again. This suggests to me that there are two kinds of ought, and they mirror a distinction between obligations and the demands of fittingness. Understood as a demand of fittingness, a radically relational moral demand is an agent's response to a situation that is warranted by the relation between the agent and other individuals involved. A demand of fittingness, in other words, is the response that a situation demands. It entails an ought, but not the ought of moral obligations. There's an important difference between the response that a situation demands and the response that can be required of you. And that's the difference between obligations and fittingness. So in short, my answer to the first objection is that while radically relational moral demands are not obligations, they are still demands. They are demands of fittingness. The second objection, targeting the necessity claim or argument, is that what I call radically relational moral demands are just demands to correctly perceive the moral properties of other individuals. If this was right, then radical relationalism would collapse into an individual's first relationalism if the relevant properties are relational properties, or a non-relational moral account of moral demands if the relevant properties are non-relational. To see the worry, consider Iris Murdoch's famous MD case. That's from The Sovereignty of the Good. The case helps us to illustrate both the objection to radical relationalism and a possible reply. Murdoch's case centers on the mother's perception of her daughter-in-law. The mother's initial response is negative. She sees her son's partner as childish and undignified. But she then catches herself and wonders whether her perception is perhaps tainted by her fear of losing her son. After taking a fresh, more loving look, she starts to see the daughter-in-law as youthful rather than childish, and spontaneous rather than undignified, etc. So we might think that Murdoch's account of moral attention supports a non-relational account of moral demands. And we find an argument of this kind in Darwell's book, The Attitude, The Heart and Its Attitudes. The thought would be that on Murdoch's view, to act rightly is to act in response to the demands that follow from the correct perception of the moral properties of the other. If this interpretation is correct, then Murdoch's ethics of attention is not a good example of what I call radical relationalism. It's a version of a non-relational moral theory. There are elements in Murdoch's ethics of attention, however, that suggest a more strongly relational view, and these elements Murdoch borrows from Simone Weil, and she acknowledges Weil's influence here. This alternative interpretation of what's going on in the MD case and in Murdoch's, what sort of underlies Murdoch's view about the ethics of attention, sheds light on how radical relationalism offers a real alternative to other accounts of moral demands. So to see this, consider that the vehicle for moral attention for Murdoch is love. And it's the same story in Luckstrup and in Weil. Murdoch's concern is with cultivating in oneself the just and loving gaze, as she puts it, that is necessary to avoid that our actions are shaped by our selfish concerns. Love, Murdoch famously wrote, enables unselfing. It frees us from the distorting concerns of the self and allows us to be genuinely open to the other. Importantly, for the point that I'm trying to make here, this openness to the other is not the same as correctly perceiving their relationship-independent properties. So moral attention, understood in this way, is neither attention to properties of the self nor attention to properties of the other. It is attention to the relation, and this sort of attention requires being in the relation. So read in this way, Murdoch's ethics of attention has a radically relational dimension. More generally speaking, the example demonstrates how a radically relational account of moral demands does not reduce to an account that grounds moral demands in relational or non-relational moral properties of individuals. So to conclude, in this paper, I've highlighted an often overlooked distinction within relational theories of moral demands. While all relational theories ground at least some moral demands in moral relations, there's a difference in how they account for moral relations. Individuals' first relationalism explains moral relations on the basis of relational moral properties of individuals, whereas radical relationalism has a relations first structure. While I did not defend any particular version of radical relationalism, I hope to have made it plausible that not all relational moral demands have an individual's first structure, and that some moral demands are radically relational. Thank you very much.